Homelessness was on the decline in the U.S., but it's creeping back up.
What has become a particular issue over the last few years is really that our country is crippled by an affordable housing crisis.
And the biggest increase was in Massachusetts.
It's a combination of the cost of housing, but it's also the instability that families experience that have really created this unstable living situation.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for August 19th. Also on the podcast, from workers to refugees, more than 90% of people seeking U.S. visas are waiting in line.
If you hear our business leaders talk, they're really worried about the impact of the current immigration environment on their ability to attract the full range of talent.
And the NFL's new social activism campaign with Jay-Z continues to draw scrutiny.
Is the movement about Kaepernick, or is it about the issues that he tried to bring into the limelight by kneeling in the first place?
It's Monday, everybody. Let's get started. For most of the past decade, homelessness across the United States has been on the decline, falling 15% since 2007. But from 2017 to 2018, data from the Department of Housing and Urban Development show that homelessness across the country rose slightly by less than 1%. Now, that might not seem like much, but the national numbers don't always reveal the full extent of homelessness in certain populations or places hit the hardest. For instance, while California saw the biggest drop in homelessness in 2017, LA County's homeless population increased by nearly 60,000 people over the past year. And a lot of you have been homeless yourselves. You told us how it affected you.
This is Chris from Hartsville, South Carolina. When I was 15, I was homeless, but still managed to graduate and go on to be in the Marine Corps. I remember the kindness of one McDonald's worker who would always leave food out by the dumpster when I came by for after-school food. To this day, I will help anyone who claims to be hungry. Whether they are or not is irrelevant to me. I wish that on no man, woman, or child, because hunger is a great equalizer.
My name is Jasmine, and I'm calling from Mountain View, California. I just want to say it's very dangerous and scary and can be very humiliating being homeless. And there are a lot of people out here that are homeless that don't look homeless. You could be Ubering during the day and sleeping in your car, or couch surfing, and vulnerable to sexual exploitation.
Hi, this is Joe Martin in Fort Collins, Colorado. I've never actually owned a home. I've always rented an apartment or a room or whatever. And I've ended up homeless 3 times for various reasons, and all for less than 2 months each. Simply finding a place to park your car so you can sleep in it is a soul-crushing experience.
Thanks to you all for sharing your experiences. And as we heard from your calls, homelessness can take many forms, and it can often be invisible to the general public. Joining me now is Sarah Rankin, the founder and director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at the Seattle University School of Law. Welcome to The Takeaway, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
So when we look at these national numbers, how much are they telling us about the true scope of homelessness in this country, particularly this less than 1% uptick?
Well, what we know is that a lot of the drivers for the 1% uptick are along coastal cities, especially along the West Coast. And we also know that those numbers are pretty stark underestimations of the overall problem. The method by which they determine the number of homeless people in the country is a volunteer effort based on a one-night count. And so these estimations are the proverbial tip of the iceberg.
Well, first of all, let's go back. There was a drop in homelessness, about 15% for over a decade. Why are we starting to see this slight increase now?
So what has become a particular issue over the last few years is really that our country is crippled by an affordable housing crisis. We know that this disproportionately punishes lower-income households and increasingly impacts middle-income Americans. There have been a number of studies that have established that a $100 increase in rent can result in a 6 to 32% increase in homelessness in a particular area. And it's also happening at the same time that we're seeing spiking income inequality, again, especially along coastal cities. We have eviction epidemics. All of these things have been relatively recent in the last few years, but it's been building over time, starting in the 1980s when we started to divest from investments in affordable housing. HUD's budget was slashed. And as a result, we've really overstressed and underfunded social service providers. So there's a lot of tangled threads that come together into this web
Sarah, I want to talk a little bit about what prompted this conversation. I live in New York City. I've noticed that in my just anecdotal experience, I grew up in the city in the 80s. As you mentioned, there were lots of changes that happened in the 80s, and it seemed like homelessness was pervasive then. It feels like it's more visible now in New York City, and some of our listeners on Twitter shared their experiences as well, saying they felt like it was also more visible. Is it more visible, or is it more pervasive, or both?
So it's really important to distinguish between homelessness generally and unsheltered homelessness in particular. I know that seems counterintuitive that there would be people who are sheltered who are homeless, but there are folks who are either availing themselves of emergency shelter or are couch surfing or are living doubled or even tripled or quadrupled up with others. So folks who are unsheltered, the majority of people who you see on the street are actually a very small portion of an overall homeless population. Here in the Seattle area, our unsheltered chronic homeless population is about 29% of our overall homeless population. And it's important to understand that people who are chronically homeless really are a specific subset of people. There's actually a technical definition for chronic homelessness, and it means that they have to have two hallmarks. The first is that they are homeless for more frequently and for longer periods of time, and they're suffering from a disabling condition that prevents them from working. So something like a chronic health problem, a psychiatric or emotional condition, or physical disability. So when the typical person is responding to the visibility of homelessness, you're really responding to your perception that there's been an increase in the number of people who are unsheltered and chronically homeless.
What's holding up? We talk a lot about affordable housing, and I'm going to extend that to, we mentioned a little bit about how HUD's budget has been slashed, so I'm going to assume there isn't much funding there for public housing. But even when we look at what's called affordable housing, and I'm using air quotes around affordable here in New York City, it feels like it's not really that affordable. I mean, what's holding up more housing to house folks that are in this position?
So, yeah, and there's a distinction, again, between affordable housing, which really creates the pipeline into homelessness, and sort of unsheltered people who need, in particular, something called supportive housing, which is a type of affordable housing that has wraparound services available. And so for affordable housing, we know that a lot of cities have extreme affordable housing crises and are not building sufficient low-income housing in order to stop the pipeline. They're also not building and siting a sufficient number of supportive housing units, which would really be what is needed to address chronic homelessness. The vast majority of cities have these complex laws that virtually guarantee that somebody who has no reasonable alternative but to live in public space will be caught up in the criminal justice system. We can show statistically that they're more likely to become sick, even more likely to die.
Sarah Rankin is the director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at the Seattle University School of Law. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Massachusetts is the only state with a right to shelter law, which means that anyone who does not have a place to sleep at night must be provided with some kind of shelter. According to the federal government, it has one of the lowest rates of homelessness in the country. But from 2017 to 2018, homelessness in Massachusetts spiked 14%, the highest percent increase in the country that year. So what happened? Joining me now is Anissa Asaibi-George. She's a Boston City Councilor at Large, and she chairs the Council's Committee on Homelessness, Mental Health, and Recovery. Welcome to The Takeaway, Anissa.
Thank you.
So this 14% spike from 2017 to 2018, what are some of the main reasons for homelessness in the area, and who's most affected by homelessness?
Well, I'll start first with who's most affected. I think, unfortunately, our children in those families are most affected. And we see that very directly here in the city of Boston, where in our Boston public schools, about 10% or 5,000 of our students are experiencing homelessness. We think there's another 1,000 students or young people, kids that are not yet in school, also experiencing homelessness. And it's a huge impact on their ability to achieve academically. It obviously brings a lot of chaos and instability to their experience as children, and we want our children to have positive, joyful experiences growing up. And for me, it's a combination of the cost of housing here in the city of Boston and in the New England and the greater Boston region, but it's also the instability that families experience through trauma, through other vulnerabilities that have really created this unstable living situation.
Given that Massachusetts has a right to shelter law, how do you explain the 14% increase just in 1 year?
Well, we think it's a combination of lots of different things, but I think first and foremost, the cost of housing and the ability and availability of affordable housing that can fit families. We also know some of our lowest income families who should qualify and do qualify for public housing don't have access. And the family size has grown. We're not building in this region enough family housing, family-sized housing. For me, here in Boston, we've talked and spent a lot of time talking about individuals experiencing homelessness and responding to that crisis with some specific steps. We need to replicate that when it comes to families.
Anissa, one of the things that prompted this conversation that we're having today on The Takeaway was just seeing homelessness seems much more visible than it has been, at least in New York, and from some of our listeners in a lot of the cities that they live in, than it has been in quite some time. Part of that visibility are things like encampments. And we know that Boston police recently destroyed and cleared out homeless encampments this month. In your role on the city council, how do you respond to that?
One of my greatest concerns about Operation Clean Sweep that happened a few weeks here in Boston is that we've disrupted the continuum of care and the ecosystem that many of these individuals in that case have created for themselves. Their internal support systems, their relationships with street workers that they were able to create. And for me, making sure and Boston's response going forward needs to make sure any individual that's been impacted by this move by the Boston police in the last couple of weeks, that we've found ways to reconnect with them with service workers. But Tanzina, one of the things that you are falling into here is we're getting away from the conversation of families, because the topic of individuals experiencing homelessness and families experiencing homelessness is a very different conversation. And it has to be a conversation that is happening side by side at the same time.
Correct. I mean, so, to your point, I think that's how we started the conversation now, was talking about families. But at the end of the day, we're also talking about human beings who have a place to live. And so I think both of those conversations are worth having. Let me ask you at the end of the day, because we're running out of time here, is there a timeline for building more affordable housing or public housing in the Boston area?
There is not a timeline with public housing. The feds, a number of years ago, stepped out of that business, and the city has stepped into that business. We as a city have become much more aggressive in building affordable housing. We have to make sure that affordable housing becomes more deeply affordable, and that, again, we're creating more opportunities for families in that affordable housing pool, because the stock that we're building is often one and two bedroom apartments and housing units. And we need to be looking towards three and four bedroom units for the growing size, family size of many of our families experiencing homelessness.
Anissa Asaibi-George is Boston City Councilor at Large, who chairs the Council's Committee on Homelessness, Mental Health, and Recovery. Anissa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
I said no to the Super Bowl. You need me, I don't need you. Every night we in the end zone. Tell the NFL we in stadiums too.
Last week, the NFL and Jay-Z announced the deal in which the hip-hop mogul's company would serve as the entertainment strategist for the Football League. The move sparked a heated debate, with many calling into question Jay-Z's motives, including current NFL player Eric Reid, who has kneeled in protest during the national anthem over the past few seasons. Prior to this, Jay-Z had expressed public support for NFL players protesting police brutality against people of color, including former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who first took a knee in 2016.
Colin Kaepernick, the 49ers quarterback, has refused to stand through the first three preseason games during the national anthem.
And he's receiving heavy boos here.
Kaepernick saying, quote, "I'm not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color."
Since then, Kaepernick has not been signed to any NFL team. Jay-Z says his NFL deal doesn't mean he's turning his back on Kaepernick or other NFL protesters.
I think we take it back. I think that we forget that Collins' whole thing was to bring attention to social injustice, correct? In that case, right, this is a success, right? Because there's two parts of protesting. You go outside and you protest, and then the company or the individual say, "I hear you, what do we do next?" Right, so for me, it was like action, actionable item. What are we gonna do with it?
To help break down the issues, I'm joined by two guests, Michael Fletcher, a senior writer with ESPN's The Undefeated, and Harry Edwards, a sociologist and civil rights activist who has worked in sports activism for decades. But before discussing the future of this movement in sports activism, I asked Michael to give us the details of this deal between Jay-Z's company Roc Nation and the NFL.
Well, Roc Nation is going to sort of help produce the Super Bowl halftime show, among other things, sort of help the NFL with its entertainment portfolio. You know, as you recall, ever since the Cap protests started, the NFL has had some trouble attracting kind of top acts, including Jay-Z himself, to do the Super Bowl show, which used to be seen as kind of a premium platform for entertainers. So that's one thing. And also, Roc Nation is supposed to help with the NFL's social justice outreach.
So when we say social justice outreach, I'd love to understand a little bit about what that means. I mean, the NFL, we should remind our listeners that they've been under scrutiny, as you mentioned, since the Colin Kaepernick protests and since he was taking a knee. He has yet to be signed by any NFL teams. And this just sort of brought the issue of social injustice, particularly against Black Americans, to the forefront of the NFL. So what has the NFL done so far, Michael, and what is this supposed to do for social justice, this new deal?
Well, some time ago, the NFL agreed with the Players Coalition to fund sort of an array of kind of social programs. The NFL owners put up, you know, close to $90 million in conjunction with the Players Coalition, which is run by Malcolm Jenkins and some other retired players. They're doing an entire array of kind of social programs, if you will, youth outreach, that sort of thing, the kind of thing you'd expect a city government perhaps to do, or, you know, rec departments around the country to do. So the NFL was kind of lending some of it, a little bit of its money and its name to that effort. But that effort was kind of seen as suspect by some because of the continuing plight of Kaepernick. And there was a lot of tension between the Players Coalition and sort of the inner circle of Kaepernick supporters. So I think the NFL is hoping that Roc Nation's involvement here will kind of lend, you know, for lack of a better term, a kind of a seal of approval to its efforts and kind of get kind of a halo effect from it.
Michael, I want to talk a little bit more about the relationship between Kaepernick and Jay-Z in just a minute. But first, Harry, you have worked in sports activism for decades. You've created, essentially originated the study of the sociology of sports. When you heard about the Jay-Z deal with the NFL, what were your initial thoughts?
I thought it was great. I think that we need to get this situation under control in terms of this constantly shifting focus to who's singing the national anthem and who's doing the halftime show and who isn't, because that's not what it's about. It is not about the anthem. I wouldn't care if they got Roseanne Barr and Carl Lewis to do a duet singing the anthem. I wouldn't care about that. What I'm concerned about are issues of social justice. And every time the issue becomes who's going to do the halftime show or who has turned them down, we move away from that focus. And I think that Jay-Z has the artistic chops to put together programs that both deal with social justice issues to the extent that that is a priority of a halftime show, and also remove that focus of who's going to be there, who's not going to be there. I don't care who's there at the halftime show. What I'm concerned about is not being able to get in my car and drive to the store and come back home without some fear that I'm going to be shot on the way. Somebody asked me if I was concerned about the possibility of protests at the first preseason game this year. Was I concerned about protests during the anthem? No, I wasn't concerned about protests during the anthem. I was concerned about being shot on the way to the game or on the way home. So we can be honest even when our perspectives are not correct. I think that it's a step forward. I simply hope that it works out.
But to your point, yesterday Jay-Z said, and I'm quoting him here, we're past kneeling and it's time for action. Harry, what's your reaction to that statement? I mean, is that an unfair characterization about what the kneeling protest was meant to do? And is he right? Is Jay-Z right when he says we're past that?
Yeah, he's absolutely right. It's past time for us to move on and become involved with action. The kneeling was a gesture of protest. Now it comes down to how do we begin to move to resolve the issue. There were seven athletes kneeling last year in the NFL, and if it were not for the current occupant of the White House who put the whole kneeling movement on life support, it probably would have been in the rearview mirror by now. As to the Kaepernick issue and the fact that he is not in the league. Look, again, we can be honest even when we're not right. 32 starters, 32 backups, and 32 clipboard holders are supposed to be so much better than Kaepernick that he doesn't even get a look. A man who took his team to the Super Bowl, to two conference championships, and one of the highest rated quarterbacks in 49er history in terms of his production. Come on, give me a break. That's nonsense. We need to be honest about that. But that is not Jay-Z's focus. That is not his job. That's a struggle for someone else to undertake. I think that Jay-Z's statement was absolutely correct, and I think it's headed in the right direction.
Michael, I want to bring you back in here because Colin Kaepernick, really with the kneeling, started this conversation in the NFL, and he doesn't seem to be, at least from what we're aware of, doesn't seem to be part of this partnership. Can you explain to us why that is?
Well, I think Harry touched on it. It's the fact that he's continuing to be blackballed by the NFL. And you hear that from his closest supporters, you know, the Eric Reeds, Kenny Stills, people who feel like the NFL's social justice work is kind of hypocritical so long as Cap is being kind of shut out of the league. I'm not sure I agree with that. I agree with almost everything Harry said, except for that bit about Roseanne Barr and Carl Lewis singing the anthem being okay. I mean, I think that would be a disaster on many fronts. But I agree with everything he said. I mean, and this comes down to, well, you know, what is this about? Is this about Cap, a man who can fend for himself? And Cap, he's made a sacrifice. And I think no one would argue, maybe the owners would, but they wouldn't be right that Cap isn't good enough to play in the NFL anymore. I mean, certainly, I think, is one of the, you know, top 70 quarterbacks on the planet. You know, some teams carry three quarterbacks, some carry two. But putting that aside, is the movement about Kaepernick or is it about the issues that he tried to bring into the limelight by kneeling in the first place?
And, you know, Michael, to that point, I mean, Jemele Hill recently just wrote about this in The Atlantic, and she says, you know, while she does talk a lot about both of their contributions to the movement, she does, and I'm quoting, she says, Jay-Z isn't getting enough out of the deal to justify the sacrifice of some of his credibility. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know what he's supposed to get out of the deal, I guess. I don't know exactly what Jemele means by that. It feels to me like we have to move beyond this idea of perpetual protest and the idea of protesting being a virtue unto itself. And, you know, protesting is a tactic. You want to protest to call attention to something. And once you've called attention to something, you want to try to do something about it. So the idea of, like, somehow being pure by continuing to protest, I don't know that I buy that line of thinking. And it's hard for me to know what Jay-Z is supposed to get out of it. I mean, Jay-Z just was the executive producer on this Amazon series that's talking about Meek Mill's journey through the criminal justice system, which I think speaks to a lot of African-American men, and particularly in this country. For an entertainer, he's done a lot on the social justice front. He's one man. I don't think it's his fight alone. He's doing his part. I think it's incumbent on all of us to sort of do our part. And if we did that, I think, you know, we'd see this issue lifted up and probably dealt with a lot, you know, in a lot more efficiently.
Harry, Patriots owner Robert Kraft apparently played a role in making this partnership happen. Kraft, of course, is a friend of the president, of Donald Trump. As you mentioned earlier, Donald Trump essentially, in your opinion, squashed a lot of the protest movement that we saw on the ground. What are your thoughts on Robert Kraft's role here in making this happen?
Well, anytime people who are in an adversarial position with you do anything that you can turn to your interest, then you always welcome that. I don't think that Donald Trump so much squashed the movement as he inflamed and fueled it, because the reality was that it was losing steam in 2018. I think also it's important that we understand that there's always this tendency for people to refocus not upon the initial goals and issues that were involved in these types of movements, but on the latest shiny object. So this time around, it happens to be Jay-Z and this deal. For quite a period of time, as the movement began to fade, it came down to whether or not Cap had a job. I mean, at the end of the day, we need to focus on what the goals are. My basic instincts tell me if Kraft had his way, we'd be looking at Hank Williams Jr. in that position rather than Jay-Z. So at the end of the day, I'm not concerned. Way to go, Robert. And I hope you do well in terms of your own issues.
Well, you've also played, Harry, you've played a huge role in the history of activism in sports, not just generally in civil rights, but really when it comes to this movement. You've talked, you've helped lead the activism that we saw in 1968 during the Olympics. How would you compare what you're seeing today to what happened then?
Well, this is simply another phase of a movement that has been going on since the turn of the 20th century. Whether we're looking at Jack Johnson and Jesse Owens, Joe Louis, the Negro Leagues, Paul Robeson, we have to understand that Plessy versus Ferguson, which set up so-called separate but equal, even though that term's nowhere in the Supreme Court edict, was not about setting up separate but equal institutions, facilities, opportunities, and so forth. It was about pushing black people back as close to slavery, to the subsistence, subjugation of slavery as possible without calling it that. And so the Negro Leagues, Jack Johnson, Jesse Owens, that was part of a resistance movement. Then in the post-World War II years, you had Jackie Robinson. That was framed up not by abject segregation, but by an effort at desegregation. Then you had in 68 the Black Power movement, which framed up a movement that was about dignity and respect. And even though we had access, there was no dignity and respect in our activities. And then you have this fourth wave, which is a struggle for definitional authority. What Kaepernick was saying, and you know, I counseled Kaepernick when he was a member of the 49ers locker room. What Kaepernick was saying was police shootings are not justifiable homicide. It's summary executions under cover of the badge. We need to face the fact that 147 black men, women, and children shot down by police in the streets of this city, most of them unarmed, is unacceptable. We're better than that. That's what Kaepernick was saying. Now we're into a fifth wave, which is really framed up by the Me Too movement, and so you begin to see these women athletes stepping up and making statements. So what we're looking at now is not something that's unique. It's not something that's unheard of. It's part of the American effort to create that more perfect union. I mean, Sam Adams and his Sons of Liberty movement was not a government program. Neither was the abolitionist movement or the labor movement or the civil rights movement or the women's suffrage movement or the environmental movement or the gay rights movement or the Black Lives Matter movement or the Me Too movement. This is we the people. And that's what Kaepernick was a part of. That's what this is a part of. I couldn't care less who was the halftime program, but it tended to shift our focus away from these issues of social justice and gender equality.
Michael, I want to close with your thoughts on some of that. I mean, I think we should note that there are folks that are criticizing Jay-Z for getting involved in this with the NFL, and they're looking at it as a money deal, really. But we should also note that Colin Kaepernick himself signed a Nike sponsorship deal. So I guess my question is, do these marketing partnerships that both Jay-Z and Kaepernick have entered into dilute the broader movement, in your opinion?
I would think not, but I would also add this. I think Kaepernick, he's had this kind of cryptic message. You know, he sort of talks through other people on social media, and it kind of puts him in a kind of holier-than-thou position when it comes to that. But I think that misses the point. I think he, Jay-Z, they're both moving and sort of trying to move the focus in the right direction. They're trying to get these issues, you know, brought into the sports arena where a lot of Americans go for, you know, just for relief from the daily stresses, but they kind of brought these issues in front of them, and by doing that, elevated these issues and made them, you know, urgent in people's minds. And I think that's something that's to their credit. And I don't think this is diluted because one guy happens to overprice jerseys for Nike or you know, another guy is doing, you know, halftime shows for the NFL. I don't think that dilutes it per se. So I tip my cap to both of them.
Michael Fletcher is a senior writer at ESPN's The Undefeated, and Dr. Harry Edwards is a sociologist and civil rights activist. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services has been seeing severe processing delays in visa applications to the United States, creating a huge backlog. And this backlog has left immigrants, many whom are seeking employment, refuge from violent crimes, or reunification with family members, in limbo. Leon Rodriguez is a partner at Seyfarth Shaw and served as director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services from 2014 to 2017. And he helped fill us in on the current status of visa application backlogs.
So the backlogs now, I think we're talking about somewhere on the order of 750,000 cases beyond their target processing times. That's a problem with which we were struggling during my time as director, but it certainly grown worse in recent years, and it's grown worse because of particular decisions that the current leadership has made.
I want to get into what those decisions are, but first I want to understand what kinds of visa applicants are being most affected by the delays, and has that changed?
So one of the statistics that we heard last month is that 94% of all visa categories are backlogged. So that runs anywhere from somebody who is applying to come short-term to the United States to do some kind of work, somebody who's applying for a green card, or somebody who's applying for U.S. citizenship. All of them are in a backlogged state.
We've heard the president say that the types of immigrants that they're interested in having come to the United States should be, at least I'm paraphrasing here, but highly skilled immigrants. Are those, and we've just said that 94% of the visa applicants are being delayed. So let's talk a little bit about the impact that this will have on the American economy, if at all, not just among high-skilled labor, but all folks that are looking to come here.
So there seems to actually be a pretty good consensus among economists that anything that makes it harder to either immigrate to the United States in the first place or to solidify your immigration posture in the United States, those are all things that are harmful to the economy. If you hear our business leaders talk, I interact with them a lot in my current line of work, they're really worried about the impact of the current immigration environment on their ability to attract the full range of talent that they need. And frankly, a lot of them are skeptical that what the administration is calling merit is really the merit that they need in order to effectively conduct their businesses.
So let's be clear on what the administration is talking about when they say merit. Are you saying that the business owners that you're talking to need workers of all skill levels?
They do need workers at all levels of the skill spectrum. So if you talk, for example, to healthcare providers, we have a shortage of nurses in this country. And we really don't have any kind of reliable immigration path, not just for registered nurses who are at the top of the nursing skill level, but even something like a licensed practical nurse or a nurse's assistant. There's shortages in all of those areas. And immigration absolutely provides a way to shore up those shortages, but we don't have a pathway for that.
Give us a sense for what some of the reasons are for these backlogs, what they were under your leadership and how that's changed under the Trump administration.
Well, part of the reason why this issue has always been a perpetual struggle is that USCIS is a self-funded agency. People who are applying for immigration benefits, they pay a certain fee. And so it's based on that fee that the work gets done. And the problem is that the way that the budget process works, you're often using two-year-old data to decide what your fees and what your staffing levels need to be today. So you're always in this constant game of catch-up. So that's a fundamental problem. And notwithstanding even the current environment, the fact is people do want to immigrate to the United States. They do want to get green cards. They do want to become U.S. citizens. And so as a result, there continues to be pretty high demand for the services that USCIS offers.
How is the USCIS responding?
The main thing that we've heard out of USCIS is that they are reallocating personnel among different locations in order to ensure that they're using their personnel in the most efficient manner. That helps a little bit. I'm not sure that we've necessarily seen a more comprehensive plan for them as to how we're going to achieve a real reversal.
I mean, is there any political will really to get this done right now? I mean, this seems to be, you know, we're hearing news about folks who are here legally with legal immigration status who, you know, are going to be penalized if they take out government benefits or use government benefits.
I have to agree. I'm sad to have to agree. There is absolutely nothing that we've seen from the current administration that shows any interest in making things easier and more efficient for legal immigrants. Rather, just about everything is something that makes the process a lot harder. And in fact, there are specific actions that have been taken that at least play a role in the growth of this backlog. And there seems no will to try to make the process more efficient in any way.
Leon, are there more resources being allocated now to funding ICE? And I just want to talk a little bit about the latest ICE raids that happened about a week ago. Is that where the administration is choosing to put its funding as opposed to shortening some of the backlog times that we're seeing here for visa applicants?
Yeah, if you look at the administration's budget requests over the last 2 years, it's very clear that its investments and its budgetary priorities have very much been on the immigration enforcement and border security side. So there have been very clear interests in the order of a billion to $1.5 billion in increases in the overall budgets for immigration and customs enforcement, for customs and border protection. But in terms of what the administration's appetite for enforcement is, even that's not enough. We just saw a BuzzFeed story about 3 weeks ago reporting that USCIS leadership was actually soliciting volunteers to leave USCIS, the already backlogged USCIS, to instead work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection in order to bolster their enforcement activities.
Leon Rodriguez is a partner at Seyfarth Shaw and served as director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Leon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's Monday for us. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.